Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS, and my name is Roy, and I'm the net control operator for this Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong for 40-plus years, mostly under the loving care of Dick, K2RIW, who unfortunately became a silent key a few years ago. And so in his memory, we continue this as an exercise in informing, educating, and entertaining each other. And I hope you've all come with questions or comments or topics of interest tonight. We took a short hiatus last Sunday night because of Rosh Hashanah, but as I promised, we are back tonight. So I hope you'll join us. Let me drop for a moment, and then I will give you the usual links.
Come back, Roy, K2OGD.
Yes, Craig?
I just want to say welcome back.
Oh, thank you very much, Craig. I appreciate it. Anyway, getting back to the links, if anyone wants to reach me via email, that would be either to ask questions, and you can't reach the technical net for one reason or another. We used to call those mailbag questions. They used to be very popular. Or if you have a topic of interest that you would either like to present yourself, be part of a discussion upon, or just sit back and listen, you can email me those suggestions. Or if you have puzzles, we're always looking for puzzles. I was looking in a new book that I just bought for puzzles, and unfortunately, I found two that I had already used last year. So be it. But if you have any puzzles, please email me. If I find that they're useful, I prefer them when they can't be answered by a Google search in a tenth of a second. So keep that in mind, and if you come up with something, please advise me. Also, if you have something space or NASA-related and you'd like Paul to comment on it, I can send him a message, or you can send it directly to him. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. His is spacenetreport@gmail.com. I have a link page full of interesting articles that I've collected in the past week, or in this case, in the past 2 weeks. They're available 24/7. You could click the links and go to them. Occasionally, they're YouTubes, all kinds of fun stuff. So check it out. The link page, you get to it by typing into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. We have a chat room. Sometimes it's busy, sometimes it's quiet. Who knows what tonight will be like. If you want to get to the chat room, again, you just go to your browser and type chat.ac2gs.com. I offer an audio stream of the Technical Net, and because a few people asked me to, I kept it live for the rest of the week. So whatever comes out of Glen Oaks goes through into the Internet feed. So if you do not have a radio access to the repeater, you can just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the audio stream for whatever's going on the Glen Oaks repeater. Also, I'd like to remind everyone regularly, Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive site. He has a Limark Technical Nets that go as far back as September 2006. His site is called amateurradio.tv. He's had over 1 million visitors in its history, so make it 1,000,001. Let me drop for a second, and I'll be right back. Okay, I thought just a little different tonight. I would share with you some bits and pieces of things that have come up in the last week. One thing, as many of you who've listened to the TechNet before know, I also usually run a 10-meter net in the morning on 28.380, and 10 meters was really, really lively this morning. I had never seen it so lively. I have a pan adapter, so I see other transmissions. They had to be more than a dozen on 10 meters at one time, which is a novelty to me. I heard people from Germany. I heard people from Spain. I heard people in Switzerland. Couldn't contact them, but during our net, we contacted people from Florida, from Oregon, from Arizona, from a lot of people in Texas. So check on 10 meters if you haven't lately. It's really bustling out there. Let me drop for a sec. Okay. Also, I think it was 2 weeks ago, W2BZ mentioned that he had just gotten a new Kindle, and we discussed Amazon's Kindle e-reader books. And I mentioned that I have one from many years back. It's, I think it's 2011 model. And I wasn't particularly happy with the size. And I was hoping that eventually, some century, Amazon would come up with a larger size e-reader screen. And the original one that I have is a 6-inch diagonal. I think they've built 6.8 and 7-inch, but it still strikes me as a wee bit too small. And just like Jeff was listening to the broadcast, to the TechNet, this week Amazon announced that they were bringing out something called the Kindle Scribe, which is designed as both an e-reader and as a scratch pad. And it has a 10-inch diagonal screen, so I'm looking forward to reviewing that. So if anyone has any comments about that, feel free, before we take regular questions, if you have any questions or comments on the two things that I mentioned, hit that push-to-talk button.
WE2KW3.
Yes, Ken.
Okay, speaking of Kindles and larger screens, at one time Kindle had a, or Amazon had a Kindle with, I forget what the size of the screen is, but it was quite large. It was called the model, from what I recall, DX, and it was made for more of a form factor of a magazine rather than a book.
Yes, they've had different form factors, but those screens, if my memory serves me, were all liquid crystal displays. E-readers, we've discussed this before, where liquid crystal displays are called transmissive display devices because the light is behind the screen, and so it shines in your eyes, and it's a wee bit uncomfortable. Most iPads are LCD. Some cell phones are emissive. They're organic light-emitting diodes. So rather than the display letting just blank light go through it in different ways, they actually emit different light. The e-readers use a different technology. It's a reflective technology. There are these little charged spheres. And, you know, one's charged, one half is positively and the other is negatively charged. And they have a layer of white dye on one side and black on the other. And by adjusting the charge potential, the balls rotate and reflect light from incoming light in the front of the display. So this 10-inch diagonal, as far as I'm aware, is their first large-size e-reader type of a screen. Okay, any other comments, questions, answers about the two things that I mentioned?
Alpha Delta 2 Delta Uniform?
Yes, Alex.
Does this have, like, writing and note-taking capability, or is it just the standard e-ink? And is it running the, like, stock Kindle OS, or is anything different in that sense? 82DU.
Yeah, it has, I believe they use Wacom's. Wacom is a very popular graphics tablet. They use Wacom technology. It's a user pen stylus that doesn't require any charging. They sell two versions. The standard is very simple, unpowered pen with a nib in the front. For a couple, you know, for I think $30 more, there's a deluxe pen that has both an eraser type device at the other end, so while you're writing, you can flip it and erase portions, and it also has a select button that's programmable. It's going to run Linux, and it has the same chips as the high-end Kindle readers have now. The operating system obviously has to be modified somewhat so that you can actually put notes into your writing. So you can take PDFs and you can take EPUBs and Mobi books, and you can make little they look like those lovely little stick'em pads, and you can scribble notes on it. So you can take notes from scratch. There are templates that are said to be available. You could load in other documents and annotate them. And, yeah, it looks like it's an interesting toy.
Yeah, I'll take a look at it. I have most of my, fun reading in the Amazon Kindle Cloud that I emailed through the sending them attachments in an email to my Kindle.com address. It works great, and the page then syncs when you're reading through your phone, your Kindle, iPad, whatever. When's this thing coming out? 82 to you.
The way that they presented it is that it will start shipping in November 30th is the date that they give. On my Amazon queue, it has it listed for estimated arrival sometimes in December. And the way they're presenting it is that it will be available for the holiday season. So hopefully they're taking worst-case scenarios and they'll ship a little earlier than they had planned. But, figure it for the beginning of December. Okay. Well, I guess we ran through my two comments. Not much interest in 10 meters, I guess. I don't know. Guys, if you have 10-meter capability, check it out. I'm not guaranteeing that tomorrow it's going to be as great as it was today, but, geez, it was great. Anyway, I, once again, am AC2GS Roy. This is the Limark Technical Net, where we try and help with questions or topics of interest and such. So if you have a topic of interest, preferably the early ones should try and focus on amateur radio, but we can discuss any science and technology. We can give it a go if you're so inclined. So I will just throw it out to the audience. Please give me your first name and your call sign.
82OGBO once again.
K2UQK, Rob.
Okay, Craig and Rob recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
Emails that I have sent you. I have some mismatched rear antenna, so the coax is getting cut. I'm trying to be as short as possible, so there will be water and hurricane rotation in two hemispheres in Ecuador. The fatal physics of falling objects, the human skull that is 1 million years old, found in China, and electromagnetic fields in phase in electromagnetic wave. Thank you.
Okay, Wesley recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Say again. I'm sorry, you're falling out of the repeater and you're about 70-80% noise. If you maybe if it's HD you're dealing with, maybe change the orientation, bring it a little bit closer to the window. If it's a radio where the output can be hiked up, try that. No, that signal was even worse. Well, try and see how you can arrange yourself, or worse comes to worse, if you have Echo Link, we do have Echo Link accesses. It's a little bit more difficult than doing the radio because you got to wait for people to stop quick keying. But you could either try EchoLink or try another adjustment in your environment because right now I can't hear you. Well, hopefully you'll try later on, maybe have better chance, better luck, and hopefully some more people will come by to the technical net with other questions. So, Craig, you're the top of the list tonight. What's your question or your comment for tonight?
I got a couple of things in mind. I actually want to give you just a quick update on something. I'm not really looking to box an XP on my main computer, since after all, if you use XP, you are vulnerable to threats and things like that, since it hasn't gotten any updates since 2014, and even with Malwarebytes, you're still not safe, and I don't really want that to affect my main computer. So instead, I'm going to swipe one of Jerry's machines that he has tons of that he doesn't really need anymore, so I'm just going to run my old games on that instead, so that would be better than going through the whole virtual box and using a virtual machine, yada, 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 so that's that. Second thing, I asked Ken this a couple weeks ago on the computer net, and I'd like your opinion on it. Stand by just 1 second. So, my Malwarebytes. There was a time where I was listening to some music with a YouTube video on my Discord. Suddenly, the music stopped. When I went to go reload the YouTube page, it said that I was offline, and it was YouTube only that it was doing this. Apparently, Malwarebytes thought that certain Google pages, like the AdSense and my YouTube videos, were containing malware, so it blocked those two websites. So I had to add the exception in for like 10 to 12 different pages, and now I'm back in. What's your opinion on that, considering that maybe it might be a bug, but what do you think?
Okay, AC2GS, by the way. For the first comment, you certainly can more fully isolate your risk using a separate computer. Although you have to realize that the nature of virtual computers, it produces a kind of sandbox effect, so that theoretically nothing outside of the virtual machine should be visible to anyone else. It has its own separate IP address, its own separate networking system, so malicious people should not theoretically easily be able to jump over that wall. So although you're always going to be more secure with a physically separate machine, having a virtual machine offers you an intermediate level of security. So that's first thing. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, the second thing is, yes, that I am aware of that. Apparently, Malwarebytes, every so often they refresh the data to individual computers. This is a kind of invisible thing they do. And at one point they reported that there was an error in their update, which included things like YouTube. That probably was corrected soon after, so probably you don't have to inherently insert your own corrective settings. It's just the database that in some ways was faulty. Now, whether it was a malicious thing or just a random accident, I don't think they fessed up to anything, so I can't tell you. But it's certainly possible there have been times that malware protection and antivirus protection has erroneously placed legitimate software on the list or access points on the list. Sometimes they correct it if it's big like YouTube, and sometimes if it's very small, they don't bother to.
Some of them usually like when people try to crack official software because they're too stubborn to pay for it, when they download the crack to bypass the override, the malware bytes will think that it's considered a PUP or riskware or things like that. And clearly, if there is something in there not only trying to crack the software, but also potentially mess your computer up, too. I mean, you're more than likely to mess your computer up rather than get into legal trouble when it comes to doing that.
Well, it's certainly higher risk using cracking software. And sometimes, because they're not really legal, a lot of these companies like Malwarebytes and other companies, if you take just a random file and rename it tgen.exe, so, you know, it's not malicious. It, you know, you could write C spot run. A lot of these protective pieces of software will seal it up and ask you to allow it to delete it because it's kind of hard-coded for things like programs that are called keygen.exe because they're very often key generators that work and key generators that don't work but implant Trojans and viruses of different types into your system.
Well, that's why I'd rather get software traditionally now. If you want probably the biggest software that definitely messed my computer up years ago that I'm sure everybody remembers back in the day, I'm sure people still use the older versions to this day, which are fully functional, but more or less likely you're gonna get into legal trouble with this one. Try LimeWire.
Oh, okay. I haven't heard that software mentioned for about 15 years. There's a lot of things that people buy cracked versions of. Games are, unfortunately for the developers, very popular. There are loads of people who are using older cracked versions of Adobe Photoshop all over the place. I'd be willing to bet that there are more old illegal versions of Photoshop out there than the licensed legitimate ones.
Gee, that's why they have freeware versions as well, where you have maybe about 70% of access to all of the premium stuff. You look at common softwares that actually offer most of the features as a premium. Look at NCH softwares like WavePad, SwitchSound, VideoPad, ExpressZip. All of those are always offered for free with no expire trials. And if you want literally 100% of everything, then just buy it. But I definitely liked NCH. I've used like 5 different programs, and years ago, the freeware version was just not as good. But now they're actually expanding it to be like 80% of all the professional and master's edition stuff. So, yeah, really, that's why they offer that instead of a trial to give people more of an opportunity rather than just trying to bypass the protocols into buying the software. KD2OGB.
Well, everyone has different methods. You can buy a partially limited piece of software and upgrade it to the full functionality by paying. Or you could go shareware with something like GIMP. GIMP has grown as Adobe Photoshop has grown. I don't think realistically you could say that they're on the same level, but they're close enough that 99% of what most people do with Photoshop can be done with GIMP. And then, you know, just last month we were talking about DaVinci software that they limit the accessory modules, but you can get a lot of functionality for free. Different companies have different models, and hopefully it works for them all so that they continue to upgrade and survive in this environment. I know a lot of people kind of dislike Adobe because they took the more money-grubbing licensing route, but I think it works for them still. If it didn't, they would change it. So, yeah, you got a lot of options with software. For the most part, I think the days of cracking hardware to put in strange programs and getting cracked versions of software are not really booming these days. All things being equal, if you have enough money to buy the stuff because you'll be able to upgrade it much more easily than a cracked version, and you'll be supporting a company that you apparently think that their products are worth it to one degree or another. So that's my little two cents on that.
I feel like maybe people are just too stubborn to pay, and they're basically like, screw you, I don't want to pay for this. And so that's why they just want to go the easy way by cracking it at risk of not only trouble, but again, messing their computer up. Because I once used LimeWire in the past, and it didn't take long to mess up my computer. And I certainly learned my lesson. You don't know what's really in those softwares. You don't know what people rig them with. That's why it's not wise to try to bypass these programs. Get them legitimately. Anyway, that's all I got for now. And this is the only Sunday that I actually am still available. Next and the following Sunday, I will not be available. Still, I will be hopping off. That's all I got for now. And thank you very much. AC2GS Net Control, KD2OGD.
Well, you're welcome, Craig. Anytime. Next on our list is Rob. What's your question or subject or topic or comment? Rob, are you out there? You checked in a while ago. Maybe you stepped away for a short period.
Are you looking for Rob or Jim? KD2VHD.
I was looking for Rob. I didn't know that I don't have it written down that I heard you check in. Would you like me to put your name down, Jim?
Please. I thought you would copy me. We can wait for Rob.
Okay, well, we'll give it one more time. I can't quite make out my handwriting. KD2-something-UK. You checked in right after Craig, so if you're out there and you got a question or a comment. Oh, well, I guess Rob stepped away. Maybe he'll come back later on the technical net. So I guess it's your turn, Jim. What's your question or your topic for tonight?
Hello, Roy and others. Welcome back. Two questions, one RF technical and one FCC technical. I'm about to put up a long antenna, a simple dipole, 160 meters, and I'm trying to come to terms with the issue of the different lengths for the different pieces of the band. And I was wondering if you could add some insight into, if I was to take a dipole, run the end of the elements over the insulator, double it back and put a cable clamp on it. So I was to have a 130 feet of wire, but I was to put 13 feet of it double back clamped to itself, so it's a great big loop. Will that function as a electrically the length of the distance from the center point to the end of the loop or to the end of the wire? I'm not sure if I'm clear on the question. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure of the way that you phrased it. It sounds to me, and I could be wrong, that you're talking about something that's called a folded dipole. There's two ways that you can fold over a dipole to meet again or abut at the ends. One is to bring it out as far away, and it's a real loop, so it would be a half-wave loop. The other would be if you kept it close to the first half of the wire, in which it would be a folded dipole. So I'm thinking you're thinking folded dipole. Am I right?
No, I'm a couple steps simpler than that. If I just go with the wire through the insulator and double it back and clamp it to the original wire, I'm basically trying to have the looped back wire function as the main wire. Just shorten it up without cutting it prematurely. Does that make it clear?
Nope. Unfortunately, it doesn't. I'm trying to imagine what's going on. We have a half wave dipole. We have a quarter wave of wire going to the right, a quarter wavelength of wire going to the other side. Now, are you then taking another half wavelength long section of wire and connecting the two? And if you are you connecting them so that the two sets of wires are nearby in parallel, you know, like twin line or speaker line or such, or is it making another two-dimensional shape other than a line?
No, a step simpler than that. It's just going through the insulator and back on itself and clamped to itself with a little wire clamp so that you can adjust the length without actually chopping off the wire and saying, oh my, I cut too much off, I can't add any back. It's just a way of creating an adjustability at the end for tuning without actually chopping the wire, just doubling it back on itself and clamping it to itself. Is that a viable concept?
Yeah, it's not only a viable concept, it's a very common concept. A lot of people do that. The old adage is, it's easier to shorten something where you have extra and then to add stuff where you don't. So most times when people are unsure of their measurements, and if you're a realist, that's pretty much all the time, you make the wire longer, and then you have a choice. You can either cut it shorter, or you can, as you just mentioned, just crimp it over and bend it over. And to a negligible degree, it will respond as though its length has been shortened by that length. It'll be a little touch different, but you can correct for any kind of slight aberrations. So, yeah, it's certainly doable, and many people do it. You generally don't want, just for mechanical reasons, you don't want to do it for a long length of wire because that adds more weight without any benefit of your antenna. And more weight puts more stresses on where you're suspending it in the air.
Understood. Just to clarify, I'm talking about uninsulated wire, so I'm not creating a kind of a stub. I'm creating just a doubling back, and basically the last few feet of wire are twice as thick in my mind. But I'm not an electron, so I need a little help here.
Yeah, even if you used insulated wire, the basic principle would be the same. It would couple so directly that there wouldn't be any significant change in the resonance. But yeah, certainly if it was uninsulated wire, it's shorted together. It's the same insulator as far as it's concerned. It doesn't realize that it's a different shape.
My theory that the electrons don't care seems to hold.
Yep, your electrons and the electromagnetic field being generated doesn't care.
Awesome. Any other thoughts from the ether on that topic before I move to the other one?
I'll translate it for people who might not have gotten that. Anyone out there have any comments about this? Any personal experiences or theoretical constructs or anything to say? Well, I guess our electrical engineers took the weekend off.
Understood. Okay, I can move to a short second question if that's okay.
Sure.
This one's less electrical and more, I don't know what to call it. I've been reading a little bit about FCC Part 97, how it regulates the amateur radio service. And I'll just read a tiny little piece of it, and I want your anybody's input on this. Part 97, subpart A, general purpose, basis, and purpose. The rules and regulations of this part are designed to provide the amateur radio service having a fundamental purpose as expressed in the following principles. I'm just going to look at sections B and C. Continuation and extension of the amateur's proven ability to contribute to the advancement of the radio art. Interesting phrase. And I'm going to let it drop to read the second one. And part C, section C, says encouragement and improvement of the amateur radio service through rules which provide for advancing skills in both the communications and technical phases of the art. So my question is, the radio art, what does that mean? And the other one is, the communication phases of the art, what does that mean? They're odd phraseologies that I'm coming to try to understand, and I was looking for some feedback. Over to you, Roy.
Okay. I mean, Part 97 is a legal brief. It's a series of rules and regulations set up governing the FCC's operation, and little bits and pieces of it are included in all of our exams. They've asked questions about it and expect us to know. You know, you could think of our hobby as two halves of a whole. And some favor one, and others obviously favor the other. There is a underlying technological nature to our hobby. How do radio work? How do radios work? How do antennas work? How to get the most out of your radio? How to adjust it to have a more readable signal, to provide one and to receive one? Antennas to get propagation and range for the bands and frequencies that you're interested in. How does it work? And if we're really lucky, people who invent new things like Joe Taylor's low signal transmission technology. So the technology improves. There are guys down on 80 meters that are working on fascinating digital switching power supplies for AM transmitters with outlandish efficiencies that aren't usually seen in the old AM radio designs of the past. So that's the technical end, and this hobby, this technical net kind of tends towards that for the most part. You know, what is a good antenna for me? Why is this not working? Why did this not happen and such? But there's also another side of the coin, and that's communication skills. The idea is once you got the equipment to communicate, you should learn the best manner to cogently transmit your thoughts and your information from yourself to other people in a way that's readable, understandable, and not annoying. So that's the communications art of how do you talk to people back and forth and exchange the most efficient amount of information in the best possible way. And the technical art is the science, engineering, technology behind having the communications.
Seems like a good explanation. There's definitely two phases or two pieces of the puzzle here that are addressed both legally and, you know, socially amongst us that are both important.
Yes, and you sort of see it in individual amateur radio operators if you contact enough of them. There are guys that like nothing but to discuss the technology. You know, what radio are you using? What antenna are you using? Have you tried this one? Do you know why that happens? And yet there are other people I've known who, if you mention something like an antenna, they get off the radio. They don't want to talk technology. They want to reminisce about a delicatessen they went to in 1942. And if it gives them pleasure or they can find another guy who will do that as well, then so be it. So you kind of see the two extremes, and then you see people somewhere, hopefully, in the middle.
It's the seems like all of those variables have a place somewhere in this realm we yak on. Would you agree?
Yes, and that's why I hopefully say that most of us fall somewhere in the middle instead of either end of the spectrum. Because, you know, there are obviously people like that. There's the gentleman who would just get out off the repeater if you said the word antenna to him. And there are other guys who you never hear on the radio who are busy in the hobby, and you bump into them and you ask them what's going on, and they're busy tinkering and building all kinds of fascinating stuff. But they just kind of test it out, make sure it works, and then they go on to tinker on something else. So they're on the other end of that spectrum. But, you know, most of us, thankfully, are somewhere in the middle, and I think that's a good place.
Sounds reasonable. So the can you hear me now is one end of the spectrum, and then the other one is, you know, what do you think of the blue moon? I'm satisfied with your answer. I'd like to hand it over for any other comments on the subject.
Well, I guess we got a quiet night out there. I hope we have a lot of people at least listening, if they're not talking. But it would be nice if they talked as well.
KD2UAH, Roy, I have a question.
Yeah, sure, Rocco.
Okay, Roy, so I was talking to a couple of guys last night, George and Andy, and I just wanted to throw this out because it was something that I had raised in the past, and we were kind of stumped at it, so I just wanted to give you an update. Let it drop. So a few months ago, I talked about my 9700 becoming deaf on a PC. And finally I got around to packing it up after trying everything, and I sent it to ICOM. And they replaced the board. They call it the PAA board, and they realigned it, and they checked a few things and updated the firmware. The radio is about 8 months old. Anyway, I'll let it drop again. So they told me that after the questions I had asked at the net all months ago, they said that basically because I had the radio hooked up to an antenna and on, I have two antennas in my attic in a closet, I have another radio, a Yaesu, and what probably happened is I was listening to the net here, and I had the other radio on another frequency, a little higher up. There's another net that goes on sometimes, I listen to that. But this radio was off. The 9700 was off. Let it drop. And so the answer they came back was that because the other radio I was broadcasting on the Yaesu, they felt that I had blown out that board or part of the front end. And on the letter they wrote me after they repaired it, they said, comments, before transmitting on another 2-meter or 70-centimeter receiver near the antenna connected to the 9700, disconnect, and they wrote it in capital letters, the antenna connected to the 9700 transceiver. Failure to do so may result in damage, in capital letters, to the 9700 transceiver. I'll let it drop. I wanted to know what you thought of that electrically. I'm not an engineer, and I don't know, you know, one-tenth as much as most of the guys on the net. It just seems very odd to me. I mean, I have the two radios. The antennas are both Comets, I think, and they're about maybe 6 feet apart, two closets in my attic, and the two radios are right next to each other. But I find it kind of hard to believe because most guys, when they have a shack, they have multiple radios, they have antennas that might be near each other, and I really doubt that guys have to disconnect the antennas on a radio when they're broadcasting on another 2-meter radio. It just sounds to me that, you know, a radio that's a pretty well-regarded radio should be that sensitive that even if it's off, you could blow out part of the front end. So your comment, Roy, and anybody else that wants to jump in, maybe Wesley, I know he's very knowledgeable. Back to you guys, KD2UAH.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of heard that topic being bounced around. Either there's something terribly wrong with the design of that radio, it makes no sense to me at all. I actually looked up what ICOM considers too much input RF on their preamplifiers, and according to their documentation, it's 20 dBm. That is a tenth of a watt. Now, how the heck you put in a tenth of a watt from a separate antenna? You know, as long as there's no weird RF short going on, you know, if you were interested in just experimenting to see what kind of power your secondary antenna that was hooked up to the 9700, you get yourself, you remove the 9700, replace it with something like a bird watt meter that reads low watts and a dummy load, and just to see whether you get a milliwatt of power that way when you transmit on the other radio. So I find it hard to believe. I would be interested in people out there with 9700s, because I am sure, because I do it all the time. I have a receiver listening to another VHF band as I'm transmitting right now. It's never hiccuped. So this strikes me as ludicrous. Either there's a short in your system someplace and it got a lot of watts, or more likely the preamp board was just very iffy and you just kind of looked at it the wrong way and it failed. So I'd be curious, because I don't have a 9700 myself, whether anyone has done that, disconnected their radio when they're transmitting on another one. I can't believe that there are, other than really obsessive compulsive people out there, who actually do that.
Roy, KD2UA, I just wanted to add that actually both the antennas were Diamond X50As, and you know, they're reasonably decent antennas, and the other radio is the Yaesu. I never transmit to this net in maybe more than 10 or 15 watts. I mean, I'm comfortable with that. The Yaesu does fine with it. I'm on the 9700 now. And as I said, I was listening to another net, as you said, probably had it on low, but I didn't think I was even listening at that point. I think I had the radio. I'm 90% positive I had the radio off because the other net had ended. So I just don't understand it. I mean, this doesn't make any sense to me. Back to you guys. 82UAH.
And WY2U.
Yes.
Hey, hi, Roy. This is Mike, WY2U. Roy, I have to respectably disagree with you on what you said about it not making sense. I'm going to assume that the gentleman is putting out about 50 watts. Does that sound about right, if he can answer my question real quick?
No, I broadcast, I'm not that far from Glen Oaks, maybe 10 miles or so, never more than 15 watts, 1.5. Back to you guys.
Okay, I'll assume 10 watts. 10 watts is plus 40 dBm. The antenna has a couple of dB of gain, probably about 6 dB of gain, both antennas, because you said they were both the same. So net gain, let's assume 12 dB. I'll make it easy on my math. Let's assume 10 dB composite gain for both antennas added together. That means, by the way, when you're 6 feet apart, I calculated the path loss between two antennas on 2 meters to be about 21 dB. So you're putting out plus 40 dBm with 10 dB of available gain in the net, plus 50 dBm, and you got 20 dB of path loss between the two antennas. You're bombing the other radio, even though it's off, with about 1 watt of power, plus 30 dBm. That's more than enough to burn out a field effect transistor, so I have to disagree with you on this one, Roy. WY2U.
Okay, you disagree. I would, again, love to see a bird watt meter hooked up to get an actual number of how many watts was coming out. It's you know, the when I first heard the story, it sounded like it was a 10-foot difference. So 6 foot makes it a little bit more problematic. But I don't know. It doesn't quite strike me as you know. I understand why you say that, but I don't know. I don't know. It's a shame that I assume you don't have a bird watt meter.
Back to you guys. This is Kenny 2UH. I just want to make a comment. It may not be 6 feet. I'm looking. It's not 6 feet. It's closer to 10 feet. The closets are not right next to each other. They're across the room. So that portion of the room narrows. It's 10 feet or even a little bit more. But a comment that the tech made before I sent the radio in is that they get very busy after field days when there are people that are transmitting on multiple radios in the vicinity, and he said that they get a lot of activities after field days with different clubs because people blow out their radios. So I don't know if that's ever happened. I've never attended a field day, but I don't know what you think of that comment, but that's what they said. Back to you guys, KD2UH.
The fact that you'd have another 3 feet of separation only decreases the gain by 3 dB or so. So I still stand by my comment. That's enough to burn out the radio. And your comment about using a bird watt meter, Roy, would be a good one. I bet you any amount of money if somebody put a bird watt meter on that second antenna while the gentleman is transmitting 10 watts, you will see close to 1 watt of power in that bird watt meter. Back to net, WY2U.
Okay, Mike, like I said, I would really like someone to do that. It's just a shame. I assume Rocco doesn't have a bird watt meter. You know, back in the old days, I think it was given to you with your FCC license, but nowadays there's less people with one. I have one from good old John KC2WGB. When he passed away, I bought it from his estate.
WA2VDH with comments.
Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to relate another type of experience, as has often happened with people on HF when they get a linear, especially a homebrew linear, and what they do is they use that old Dow key relay to switch the antennas from the output of the linear to the receiver. Because that Dow key relay only has about, I think, 40 or 50 dB of isolation. And when they're running high power, they can get enough RF back, stray coupling through the relay back into the receiver to cook the front end of their receiver. So those kind of things happen. I think the gentleman that commented before is correct. You're getting enough RF back from the coupling of that antenna in there to cook the front end of the receiver.
Okay, that's a good point, John. I thought about switches, but Rocco didn't add. The way he described it, it was two completely separate devices. There was no switches in between the two.
Roy, I got one more comment about field day.
Sure.
Yeah, what he said before is quite correct. I guess he's talking to the technicians over at ICOM. Field day can be a situation where you've got many antennas, several antennas, in the near field of each other, where transceivers are putting out 100 watts or so. I'm assuming they're not going the 4 kilowatt or thereabouts. But, you know, a couple of transmitters operating 100 watts, if two antennas have to be, or two stations, rather, happen to make a mistake of putting the stations on the same band and frequencies that are close to each other, let's say 20 meters, one being on phone, one being on CW, that's only a separation of about 150, maybe 200 kilohertz or so, certainly in the passband of each other's systems. And it's quite possible that a 100-watt transmitter can blow out another receiver 30 or 40 feet away on HF. And what he said about field day having a lot of repairs due to that exercise, I quite agree that could happen. So back to net, WY2U.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, I would agree as well. I mean, unfortunately, things like field day are a setup for that type of problem because there's only so much real estate you can put up antennas, and you can't really all the times coordinate what bands people are on, and eventually, if allowed for random decisions, you're going to land upon a situation where two guys are going to be operating way too close and way too high power, and I'd be curious about the amount of repairs during the month of a field day. I am sure it is the peak of the year.
That would be good data to have. I wonder if I'm sure they keep log records of that, and if anybody has a contact over at one of the repair facilities, maybe that would be good information to pass around as a no-no, that things you don't want to try to do on field day. And I would recommend if you're going to have a field day operation, try to orient yourself so that you never have stations operating at on the same band, if possible. Try to do some band management. Of course, it's easier said than done sometimes. But if you could, that would mitigate a lot of problems. Of course, the other issue is, what about harmonics? Well, the good news is the second harmonic of a well-designed transceiver system is usually several tens of dB, maybe 50 dB or so below the fundamental, and that probably would not do any damage to a front end. You might jam the guy or whatever because of a strong second harmonic getting in the passband of the band that's related to twice the frequency, but that wouldn't do any damage, just be annoying because you couldn't copy anything. Back to net.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem most people thankfully have with nearby signals is desensing rather than blowing out their front end. I've had lots of experience where my radio gets desensed and it's just a random hiss of noise. And thankfully, I haven't shorted out anything. My different antennas are about 20 feet away from each other, slightly different elevation, so I've never had this particular problem. But getting back to field day, I think one of the big problems is coordinating things. Some organizations do a very good job, but most people kind of end up being semi-random. So, yeah, the secret is in coordination, making sure that you know who's on what antenna, doing what frequency, to lessen the risks. But, some field day systems work better than others.
Yep, I agree, Roy. Very good. That would make a lot of sense if there could be that kind of coordination. Real quick, last transmission, just to kind of close the loop on the original discussion. If it is possible, I think his name is Roy. Roy, if you could possibly borrow a bird watt meter with a half-watt element or a one-watt element on the VHF band, that would certainly be a measurement that I'd recommend you make. Transmit into one antenna, measure the power into the other antenna using a watt meter, and we can close the loop on this discussion once and for all, and I think that would be something other people would certainly like to know. That would be a good measurement. Back to net, WR2U.
Okay, Mike, I'm Roy, he's Rocco. Just out of curiosity, Rocco, do you have anything like a bird watt meter, something that will read in the 1 watt range?
Hi, Roy. The only meters I have are the standard SWR meters. I don't have a specific meter. They'll read, as an SWR meter, they'll read... Yes, they can read under 1 watt. Would I be able to use a regular SWR meter in place of a watt meter?
Yes, if it reads true power.
Okay, thank you. Then I can do that. Thank you. This is KD2UH. Back to the net.
Comment.
Yes, please, comment.
How copy is K2GJE?
About 40% noise, but you're readable.
Maybe this is better?
Yes, this is much better.
I might use the Dalkey series of antenna switches. I think most people do not nowadays. They're using transceivers where the transceiver takes care of everything. But I still have some boat anchors where the transmitter is separate from the receiver. Dalkey has an option on those relays. They mentioned about a 40 dB separation, but Dalkey has an option which they call G. They call it the G option. The G option gives you 85 dB of separation between the transmit and receive terminals. Over.
Okay, very good, Ed. Thank you. That's good to know. For people out there still using the good old equipment, my equipment is relatively new. I don't have anything that has a vacuum tube in it. It's all solid state, and with the exception of the bird watt meter, I guess, everything in my shack has been built in the last 10 years.